Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can also find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about the new play that is opening this Sunday called Seven Jewish Children, and we'll be speaking to photographer Lucian Niemeyer about his new book of photographs of Darfur. Right now, I'd like to introduce, joining us by telephone, Adam Del Deo and Jim Stern. They are producers and directors of the documentary Every Little Step, which opens this Friday at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to have you.
Great to be here.
This is a documentary about the Broadway show A Chorus Line and the casting of the more recent Broadway version of the show several years ago. The first show was a 1975 production, and it's very interesting because Chorus Line itself is about auditioning for a Broadway show, and then the documentary is about people auditioning for A Chorus Line, lots of levels of interplay between life and art. And actually, sometimes I couldn't even tell what was the play and what was the documentary. How did you come to make this film?
Well, this is Jim speaking. I've produced a lot of Broadway in addition to the film work that I do, and knew John Braglia, who was the executive producer of the film ultimately and was the producer of the revival. And John had seen our prior film, which was a film called So Goes the Nation, which is a political film. And he thought it was great, and he gave me a call. And probably the subset of documentary filmmakers and Broadway producers is fairly narrow. And he had these tapes, these original tapes of that Bennett had made all those years ago, which led to the show, which was incredibly thrilling. So I gave Adam a shout.
Yeah, we had a conversation about what we could create and what potential existed in the documentary, and one thing that really struck us, separate of the iconic nature of the show and the fact that it has won more Tony Awards on Broadway than any show at that point in time, and the fact that it had won the Pulitzer Prize, what struck us was that there were these multi-layers in place, that we could follow thousands of dancers in New York struggling, making huge sacrifices to do what they love so much, perform and dance and sing on Broadway, all with the hopes and dreams of one day getting the job. And the fact that Michael Bennett had created a play about that and examined those themes 30-plus years earlier to us was really interesting, that we could create a documentary that had all these layers and different levels that would mirror off each other.
Tell us about those original tapes from the mid-1970s, which led to the creation of A Chorus Line.
Well, it was an amazing night. I mean, it was January 1974, and Michael Bennett gathers about 19 singers and dancers together and asks them questions about their lives. And it was a very bad time on Broadway. It was a very bad time in New York. And Bennett had been sitting actually and watching the Watergate hearings at that point sort of obsessively and was thinking about people's need to sort of step forward and tell the truth. So he gets a reel-to-reel tape recorder, and he records for this 10-hour session, aided by large quantities of wine and whatever else was available at the time. And these dancers and singers began just to talk about their lives incredibly openly, really led by Bennett's openness himself, and that became verbatim the show A Chorus Line.
It's amazing because if I understood the documentary correctly, that session started at midnight.
It did. No, it literally, like, it was midnight till 10 in the morning. So,
and the reason they had to start at midnight was because some of the dancers that and performers that were at the session, they had plays, so they had to perform that night, and they didn't get off till 10:30, 11-ish, and then they all met up and started at midnight, so they'd all be available.
I
would imagine it also had the added benefit of people's guard really being down at that time of day, so truth-telling is a lot easier.
Yes, especially with wine and marijuana.
Right.
Sure. Slight joke, they're 21, they're 22. The thing about A Chorus Line, which was interesting, which was all sort of came out of that night, is that it was the first confessional piece ever done on the commercial in a commercial setting. It was before Oprah Winfrey. It was before confessional literature.
Mona Simpson.
Mona Simpson took that turn, and this was the first time. And Bennett really was sort of focused on putting people in front of a mirror and say, tell the truth, which was came out of the whole Watergate thing. So he didn't know. He did not know what he was going to find. He did not know if there was going to be anything there. If it was just going to be a long and interesting night. It wasn't a time when group therapy was particularly popular, and he sort of created all this himself. Ultimately, he then takes those tapes, and he creates and he does what's called a workshop, which is when you just put something on its feet and you try it, and then you rewrite off of what the actors are doing in the workshop, which is now commonplace for how Broadway musicals are done, and that had never been done before. So it was quite advanced for in its form.
And coming into making the documentary, we knew that Michael Bennett had many geniuses. When we heard the tapes, we kind of added to the list of his things that he was able to do. And one of them that we didn't know about was his ability to communicate with people and have them open up and trust him. No other person on Broadway, I believe, would have been able to get the information out of those performers that Bennett did that night. There was something about him that was so almost magical in a way, and that people confided in him in a room where they, in some instances, the people didn't know each other, but they really spoke to him as though he was a therapist and there was a one-on-one session going on. It was incredible to hear the intimacy that people gave that night to Michael. It was incredible.
Yeah, I also think that, as actors, the one advantage, I suppose, is that once an actor hears somebody's story, they're going to want to top it themselves. So that also allowed for some pretty interesting stories to be told.
I think that, such a tribute to Michael Bennett, who died in 1987, this film, as well as being about people who were just little children when he was, or maybe not even born when he was doing his thing and creating A Chorus Line. And I just love the fact that his creative process is as much the artwork as the finished product itself.
I agree. I mean, that's really perceptive. I mean, from somebody who develops a lot of films and works with all sorts of writers all the time, it's astonishing, how forward-thinking he was in terms of how he went out to create this show in a way that had never been done before.
So there are some great and some not-so-great auditions. They're wonderfully edited together. One of the high points for me was Jason Tam auditioning for the part of Paul. It's probably the longest shot in the film. I cried. The people who he was auditioning for cried. And I wondered, did he as a performer keep up that intensity in the run of the show?
Well, the one thing about being an actor on stage is you have to be able to repeat performance 8 times a week. And I think that there's a performer that does not get the role, and I don't want to give too much away, but it's clear that she nails it sometimes and cannot nail it other times, and she doesn't get the part. So I think that I think that learning that kind of technique is really critical. I mean, all performers have some nights when they're sort of magically just perfectly on, and other nights where they're not. I mean, that's the difference between theater and film. But that being said, you got to nail it, and if you can't, then you really can't work in the commercial theater.
It's interesting that some of those people who didn't get the parts, and I know who you're talking about, and we won't give it away. I mean, I loved some of those folks who didn't get the parts. Do you think this documentary will give them exposure that's helpful to them?
Oh, sure. I mean, they all come off really well, and all exposure is really great. And even somebody who we have a little bit of fun with in the film actually came to see it, and we were sort of like thinking, oh my gosh, because it was a night that we were actually doing a Q&A, Adam and I, and he came, and people saw him sitting there in the audience, and they asked him, they made him get up and say, and he said, I loved it. This was me up there. I think it's really, really good for everybody.
I mean, I think people, what separates this film from the many shows on television that deal with auditioning is that the subjects in our movie, they're really professionals. They have sacrificed so much to exist in an arena where they can perform and on Broadway. And they, you know, as Jim likes to say, they would rather give up a meal than give up a dance class. And so, you know, we were really in sync with Michael in terms of showing dignity and respect to those that work every day and pull up their roll up their sleeves and pull up their bootstraps to exist on Broadway. Jim and I felt the same way in making the film, that we want to show that same respect and dignity, win or lose, get the part or not, for everyone that was going through the audition process.
So we're talking about the film Every Little Step, which is opening at the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe this Friday night. You follow the lives of a few of the performers, some of whom do and some of whom don't get cast. How did you choose among the thousands whom to follow?
It was really difficult, and we shot 450 hours of footage over a long period of time, and it took us about a year and a third almost, or whatever, at least that much, to cut the film, because there was probably 50 performers who we actually followed pretty intensely. Now, I've done a lot of Broadway, and so some people that I had a pretty good sense were going to go far on their audition, and that was helpful, but you have to be there and shoot. You can't. I mean, if you're going to get the moment that you're studying with Jason Tam, it doesn't happen if you're not in the room. And that means that we've been in the room for days before that shot is even is able to be utilized.
We also put special focus on the iconic characters in the play.
Right.
Sheila, Paul. We put special emphasis on the role of Cassie. Because of Donna McKechnie's role and how important that character is to the play. So those key, more well-known characters in the show, we had a primary focus on with our cameras. And the other thing that we did to follow characters is, every day we were shooting, from the beginning we were listening in very closely and were privy to the meetings that Bob Avian, the director, and John Braley, the producer, and Jay Binder, the casting director, were having. So out of, 100 people trying out for Val that day, there would be two or three that they would think would have a shot to make it, and that would then tip us off to kind of more closely follow those characters.
It's interesting that people who were involved in the 1975 production and going forward were involved in the casting of the recent production. And there's a lot of choices they have to make, one of them being, do you cast the people to be like the ones who were there before, or do you allow new energy into the play, into the theater, into the show?
Right. I mean, I think this group was very conscious of doing, what they thought Bennett would have wanted. So they were very conscious of mostly following the kind of characters we were before. But, in the case of, one particular character, it was a radical departure from what had been there before. So it was a mixed bag.
Did they, in the recent production, update it so that it didn't have so much of a 70s look or feel to it? Or is this production, A Chorus Line, a timeless work of art?
This was a museum piece. Doesn't mean that it can't be updated, but they very consciously decided. I mean, the costume design is identical, the choreography is identical, the sets are identical, and so they very consciously decided to do the same show as it had been done. I think that you could do A Chorus Line and have it be an updated show, and I think it would be great. I mean, I think that there's different ways to approach it, but this was their approach.
The art and the craft that go into making a Broadway show are at the same level and really a level of multi-talent that you don't see in so-called high art forms.
It's really true. I mean, people forget. I mean, I always say that the most difficult task you can undertake is to do a Broadway musical, because it combines so many different aspects. You have to really be able to, to have a great score. You got to be able to have choreography which works within the context of what you're doing. You need to have scenes, on a book which need to support the score and vice versa, and it is brutally difficult to make one of these things work. I mean, I produced The Producers and Hairspray and all sorts of things in New York, and it is not easy. And so, I mean, I love it and have the greatest respect for it, but it's its own unique, and I think quite, it was one of the only really indigenous American art forms along with jazz.
Adam Del Deo and Jim Stern are the directors and producers of the film Every Little Step. It's a documentary about the auditioning, the casting of the recent production of A Chorus Line. It opens this Friday at the CCA here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to introduce Maura Du-Studi. She is director of the play Seven Jewish Children, which is being performed this Sunday, July 12th, at 7 p.m. at El Museo Cultural here in Santa Fe. And Ellen Fox, she's a psychotherapist, an acting student of Maura's, and a performer in this play. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So this is a very short, very intense play by the playwright Carol Churchill, written in response to the Israeli attacks in Gaza earlier this year. It's short, and nothing is said directly, as far as I can tell, having read the script, to really place it in time and geography. A lot of it is inferred by the knowledge of the audience. Tell us how the play is constructed.
The play is constructed into seven very short scenes that are almost just sound bites of dialogue. And the playwright didn't give us any indication of who says what, who the characters are, or even the time or place that these scenes occur, which was of great interest to me as the director. That's one reason why I agreed to take on this project, was I thought a lot could be shaped by how you chose to make those choices, you know, how you chose to allot the lines to different actors and who you thought they were. And although it won't be delineated in the performance, I'm hoping, as an acting teacher and as a director, the performers and I have talked about where we think it's occurring and who these people are and background, all good basic acting practices. I hope that by making these choices, it colors the play, you know, in a particular way.
There is an arc, I think, in the play that moves from a suggestion that it begins in the Holocaust through European immigration to Israel, through the possible evacuation of Arab villages and Jews taking those over, through the Seven-Day War, to the whole settlement issue, and ends with the Gaza War of January. And I think that that is there to look at the narrative of Israeli identity and how the actions that have ended, that how Gaza has happened.
Well, I think the genius of this play is that the script is answers to questions from children that you don't hear.
That's right.
Yeah, well, actually, there are answers for four children who, don't appear in the play. There's no children in the play. But really, it's more about the adults in each of these children's lives trying to figure out how to inform or not inform them of what's going on, what the events surrounding them are. I think that that's another thing that fascinated me about the play. There's several different voices, if you will, almost in each scene, different points of view of how much we should inform our children, what's safe to tell them, what's comfortable, and that really says a lot, again, about how intergenerationally we inform our children so that their opinions are formed, and again says a lot about maybe the progression of how the events that we're dealing with today came to be.
I think it also brings up, and this is a very universal aspect of the play, it brings up a lot of questions about children's innocence. What do we tell them? What do we choose not to tell them? Whether it be about political issues or family issues or anything else. And the truth, you know, what can they handle and not handle? And then the truth and lies and sort of obfuscations that then adults have in themselves that they internalize from what they're told, because of course today's adults are the children who were being told these answers that are the script of the play.
Exactly, and that's one of the things that's so interesting about it. And it is a big issue. I mean, you know, just as a parent, I have a 15-year-old myself, and, you know, all through his school years, just now I'm feeling very, you know, feeling that I must be very candid with him and truthful about things that when he was 7 or 8, of course, I wanted to either shield him from or soft pedal, because children can't take a lot of trauma, really. You know, so it is a big issue.
Well, I can relate to that very personally in terms of the narratives I heard growing up in Brooklyn as a Jewish girl and being sent to Hebrew school, at that time against my will, but being very steeped in Jewish culture and being very excited about the Israeli victory in the 67-day war, and then gradually more and more coming to examine what was I really being told, what was really going on, what values that I consider to be Jewish begin to be violated, especially now. And so I have really changed my perspective from what I was told to a much more critical, a kind of critical thinking approach as I got older. And I think that that's very much what our group is about as well, because we formed with the war on Gaza, and we formed because so many of us were troubled that basic Jewish values were being violated.
And the group is called Another Jewish Voice.
Of Santa Fe.
Of Santa Fe. And there's many other groups around the country called Another Jewish Voice in many other cities.
Yeah.
And it's made up of Jews and Gentiles.
Yes.
So, and this is the group that's presenting the play. And it's interesting for you as a director, Mara Dew-Studi, that almost none of the people in the play are actors. They're members of the group. And so they're bringing to it the passion about these issues.
Very much so. And as you may know, I'm an acting teacher here in Santa Fe,
right,
as well, and Ellen has actually worked with me, so she's one of our professional actors.
Well,
but, you know, when people are so connected to an issue and so passionate about it, it's amazing and a wonderful thing to see how just giving them a few basic acting tools and some basic acting direction, and they can really step up to the plate and do a wonderful job, and I'm very proud of everybody.
And the other thing that I've been fascinated with is we have a cast of very diverse people with very diverse experience, and many of our people are 67, 70, 80, and how the life experience comes through in the performance is very rich.
Interesting.
You know, and actually one of the most enriching things about this experience for me has been, as I said, when I looked at the script, you know, it was wide open to interpretation, and certainly my interpretation as a director of, you know, how the events unfold and who these people are, but it's been a wonderful and fabulous education for me to open up and ask the people of the group who have this wealth of life experience. I mean, there's a couple of people in the group that are
over 80.
80, yeah. You know, who were there, basically, or, you know, lived through all these things and have just so many wonderful opinions and tales to tell. And it was, like I said, I just opened myself up and said, I'm not as well educated on this issue as you are, so please inform me. And it's been a wonderful lesson.
We're talking about the play Seven Jewish Children, which is being performed this Sunday, July 12th at 7 o'clock in El Museo Cultural here in Santa Fe. And what's one of the interesting things about the play is that it can be read or performed by any number of actors.
Right.
2, 20.
Yes, as a matter of fact, there are several versions on YouTube that have done. It's being done all around the world. I mean, even as we speak, who knows, it's mushrooming. And so there are several versions on YouTube that have been done in England and in the United States.
Israel. There's one on Israel.
Yeah.
Really?
And,
yeah.
Street theater. Very effective.
Everyone is different. So, you know, it really is up to the interpretation. I mean, the interpretation of the director or the actors really colors the play. And that was one thing, looking at some of the performances on YouTube, I was very interested in presenting it differently than
right.
what I'd seen heretofore.
Yeah, I want to add to that. Our group really did struggle with whether we should do this or not. And basically, everybody agreed, yes, we should do it, because we're aware that the first criticism that we will probably hear is that it's anti-Semitic.
And it has, in fact, generated that controversy elsewhere.
It has before, right. And that's a conversation that I would like to really open at some point, because I think that's a very superficial first reaction to the kind of inquiry that the play is presenting.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. As a psychotherapist, you see people's reactions when they are caused by trauma and when they're, you know, rational responses to the event happening in the present tense. And I feel, and you know more about this than I do, but I feel sometimes that the reaction, oh, that's anti-Semitic, or oh, you're anti-Semitic, or whatever, is a kind of traumatic reaction.
I think that's right. It's my theory, but not just my theory, that a lot of the transition from acts of being oppressed to acts of oppression in this particular context come from a population that has a lot of unhealed trauma. And when you don't heal trauma, you perpetrate trauma again and again and again. And so I think that that's correct. When I was in Israel myself, I tell this story. I was there in 71. I could literally feel viscerally how much anxiety there was in the air. I think people are still very frightened, and in certain ways that's been cultivated, perhaps not for the best ends. And so I do feel that, you know, this is one way that we have moved from being oppressed ourselves to oppressing others.
And that was one of my interests in doing the play, was I wanted to expose the fact that there is that trauma. And right or wrong or whatever the result is, that, you know, it needs to be understood to help heal the situation as well, I think. And so that was kind of my reaction to a couple of the other presentations of the play that I saw on YouTube. They were very aggressive and not understanding of that part of the picture. And so I felt it was important to do a presentation that did have a little more understanding of that issue.
I think I want to say that Maura has really brought to the play a great deal of humanity. She told us in the beginning she wanted us to do this with compassion and from a heart place, and I really feel that her direction has achieved that, and that that's where we're coming from.
And that's a powerful place from which to take on issues that are very divisive, because it means having compassion for every player in the drama.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so what we've done is we've also set it up so that after we do the play, which is only about 20 minutes, we want to have a conversation with the audience about what has been brought up for them, what are their thoughts, feelings, and reflections, so people can share with each other what it's been like for them to watch this play.
So this play has actually generated quite a bit of controversy worldwide.
Well, I think one of the things is that, again, I think the way it's presented, you know, if it's presented with an aggressive attitude or it can just, you know, immediately put people off, so that all they hear is, you know, the one part of the sentiment without really hearing the nuances to it. And again, as I said, I was very interested in exploring the nuances of the experience of these people.
Well, there are real questions of, you know, what do we tell our children? Do we frighten them? You know, do we create an identity of victimhood? You know, do we just give them a Zionist story? Do we tell them both sides? And I think the play explores that beautifully in a really short period of time.
Yeah.
It's an exploration.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point, because the play is so open to interpretation in acting, in the meaning of the lines, in the whole thing, that it's just a very good artwork, so that when people see it, it's a vehicle for all kinds of discussion and perhaps healing and perhaps insight on the part of the audience.
And another reason that I was so interested in taking Ellen up on her offer to direct it was I really wanted to assist AJV in allowing Santa Fe to participate firsthand in this dialogue, you know, allowing them to see the play firsthand for themselves, presented by members of their own community with our own particular heart given to it. And, you know, allow them to participate in this, what's a worldwide dialogue about this play.
So the playwright Carol Churchill has provided the play for free to basically anybody who wants to perform it, provided that they request donations from the audience for medical aid for Palestinians.
That's right.
So that's what you're doing.
And as long as we don't make any money off of it ourselves, right. We're not.
Right. Now, this has been an amazing self-organizing process. We don't have a producer. Everyone has just showed up, picked up the work that needs to happen, and done it. It's just been wonderful. Very collaborative.
Very interesting.
Yeah, this is an amazing group of people that I've been working with.
So the group is called Another Jewish Voice, and the play is Seven Jewish Children, this Sunday, July 12th at 7 o'clock at El Museo Cultural, directed by Maura Dustudy, and one of the performers is Ellen Fox, and there's a handful of other people in it as well.
That's right.
Oh, and I should say that we've been really gifted, because El Museo has practically given us the theater. People have been stepping up, doing our lighting, our videography, all of that. So
yes.
We've been really gifted by the community in doing this
and
play.
We have a beautiful a musical soloist, Elena Saposi,
right.
That's going to play violin selections during the production. And we've got some wonderful visuals going with it that have been provided by the group. So actually the play, which actually, if you read it, runs about 7 minutes, by the time we get done with it, will probably be about, I don't know, 15 to 20 minutes.
Still a very short play.
Yes, very short.
And this performance is dedicated to
Bassan Abulish and her two sisters, who were all killed during the Gaza War.
And who is she?
She was one of the girls from Creativity for Peace Camp.
And that is the summer camp.
Yes, that's the summer camp that brings Israeli and Palestinian girls together.
So she was a camper here
in
Santa Fe.
She was a camper here in Santa Fe.
Well, we look forward to seeing you on Sunday evening at 7.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks both so much for being here. We're going to take a break right now, and Lucian Niemeyer will be with us in just a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Lucian Niemeyer. His new book of photographs is called Darfur, and he will be at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe tomorrow, Friday, July 10th, at 6 in the evening. Collected Works Bookstore at their new location on Galisteo Street, right on the corner of Water. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. The Collected Works, a new store, is quite something.
It really is. It's fantastic.
I'm proud to be there.
And it's got a huge space for readings like this.
Precisely.
Let's talk about this book, Darfur. Very beautiful and intense and important book. You start the introduction in Western Sudan, in the region of Darfur, or the homeland of the Fur tribe. One of the great travesties in human history is taking place. Brown Arab Muslims are killing black African Muslims in an ethnic cleansing abetted by the government of Sudan. You can trace the roots of this genocide back a few years or hundreds of years or even thousands of years.
Back to 3000 BC. It's an enormous story. In fact, that whole corner of Africa is the front line of humanity. It starts in early pharaoh times when the pharaohs, the Egyptians, went up the Nile and took prisoner Nubians, which they enslaved, and took their herds for food to build their great works. And later, when the Egyptian empire waned, the black pharaohs took over, and they were the land of the Kush, or they were Nubians. They too waned around 600 BC, and the Syrians came down and took over the whole coast of Africa from Tanzania to the northern part, and of course that is called the Red Crescent. Where they interacted with the black natives, there you found the humanitarian problems. So it's a long time coming. When the British ran Sudan and Egypt, they determined that in Sudan that it was too big a country to be governed by two places, so they took the capital and put it in Khartoum. Juba, which was the capital of the black and the animist and the Christian, was disenfranchised. So from that time, 1883, you had the problems that occur today, and that is the disenfranchised black run by the brown Muslim. For many, many years, the northern tribes, the black intermarried with the Muslims, brown, and they took their language, Arabic, and they took their religion, Muslim, Islam, and the gap was closed substantially, so that sometimes you cannot tell the color differences when you go to Darfur. In Khartoum, there were many judgments done on the people in Khartoum, in Darfur, especially the black, because of the fact that the Sahara Desert was moving south, there was no water. The brown nomadic tribes pushed down on the fur farmers. When there was a conflict between the fur farmers and the nomads, Khartoum always sided with the nomads. It came to the point where a few military outposts were overrun in that distant land, and Khartoum had a problem. They were engaged in the north-south conflict, which was huge, which 2 million died and many, it was huge. And they had all of their military assets being used for that particular problem. So they had this uprising in Darfur, which is a size of France, and has approximately 6 million people. In that area, they had what they call the Janjaweed. The Janjaweed were the brown nomadic tribes people, but they had also served as mercenaries in the Chad conflict. Subsequently, it became easy for the Khartoum government to hire these Janjaweed to put down the rebellion, and they did so with a fervor. And all of a sudden, that gap, which has closed quite a bit with intermarriage, the color, all of a sudden was open as big as the Grand Canyon. You had brown nomadic people killing black, throwing them in the wells, raping the women, saying, "We want a brown race." That gap was totally split asunder.
And how could that be when there were so many people who were products of both races and both cultures?
What happens is the easiest is when you can see a difference between black and brown. But what happens in this kind of a conflict, when this kind of a genocide takes place, all of a sudden you look for the nuances, and you ask for the nuances. So it goes down and splits the whole community.
So somebody who, for example, a family that genetically had two children, one of whom looks more black and one of whom looks more brown, would be split asunder.
Could be. For sure, there was such a impact of the brown nomads coming down on camels and horses. And then later, when they were thin because of the sheer number of people, then came in the government with their tanks and their jets and their help. And the black fur farmers were no match. They had no army. They had some people that gathered together to form a defensive pact, and they had some rebels that formed a defensive pact, but it's a disastrous situation.
And so here we are in this disastrous situation, and the UN doesn't do anything?
UN is not very capable in these situations. The NGOs of the world came in and really did a job. You have to remember that 6 million people were scattered, and you had two cities, one of which was Nyala and one was Al-Fashir, both under 200,000. And all of a sudden, because of this conflict that happened, they grew to over 2 million, or 1.5 million and 2 million. And what you had was all the people came to these refugee camps where they could find safety and security. Now you have ringed around Nyala 2 million people that are in these refugee camps. They get water, they get food from the NGOs, from the 80% from the United States, in fact. They get medical help, they get schooling, they get many things that they didn't have. But when Al-Bashir was indicted recently for war crimes, and humanitarian crimes in the world court, he told the major NGO organizations to leave Darfur, which shattered the ability of the refugee camps to survive. They had no place to grow anything. They had water there, but they had no place to go to get food or to get anything. So right now you're having a real mass starvation situation and mass migration again.
And so, as you write in the book, if you want to commit genocide, poisoning and starvation are more efficient means than going in with guns and killing people.
Moving people away from their water and their food in Africa is deadly, absolutely deadly. An interesting story. I went into southern Darfur. Very, very difficult. There's nothing there. There's no. There's. It's just track land. You can't even get there. You go in through a runway that a dirt strip that barely can hold a plane, and it's not easy. A friend of mine takes care of. He found 5,000 people in this wilderness track that were starving. So he took them over. He was an NGO, Persecution Project. He took over the feeding of them. He went in and dug 8 wells. As soon as he dug the wells, all of a sudden it went to 15,000. When I went in, it was after the rainy season, the first plane in. 7 of the wells weren't there anymore. The number of people had gotten down to 8,000. Now, this was 2 years ago. Since then, he has dug 36 more wells. Now, there are 200,000 people that have left Darfur to go to this refugee camp, extremely large refugee camp. When I looked for a map of Darfur, I went to the United Nations, and they had a good map that I needed to use. And I asked them if I could place this refugee camp nomenclature on the map. And they said, we do not know anything about that camp. It had been there for 5 years, 4 years, 5 years. They said, we didn't know. Let us check. They checked for four or five months. There is no such thing. 200,000 people living, and the United Nations has a huge division for displaced people. And this camp is not known.
And you were there.
I saw it.
Yeah, and you took photographs.
Pictures, yes. Yeah. Yeah. So they had a hard time understanding it or knowing it. They still don't know it.
How very odd.
Extremely. I find the United Nations very bureaucratic, very shallow. They are in the periphery. Their jets stay parked. Their cars are beautiful. Their camps are filled, and they have their planes come in to bring fruit and things like that, but they don't leave the camps. That was the case in the Nuba Mountains.
So tell us about your trip. I mean, this is your second Africa book. How did you decide to go back, and what was it like going back for a second time?
I have been lecturing all over the United States on the first book. It seemingly has had a wide audience. In doing the lectures, I was always asked about Darfur. I made the decision that I had to do it. I knew that the difficulty was going through Khartoum, because they had heard of my book, and I said, they're not going to let me in. My cousin, who took me into Rwanda at the time, said, Lucian, I can get you into Darfur. I said, you know, it's very difficult. He says, trust me. So what happened was that I flew into Uganda, met with the ambassador to Uganda from Sudan. And he said he was known by to Richard and to an imam there. And so they gave me a visa. But they said it had to be approved, because there is no visas given to reporters to go to Darfur.
And were you considered a journalist?
Sure. Yeah. I've done it. Oh, the rest of the story is interesting. So what happened was that I flew into Khartoum, and they had a big dinner for us. And at the dinner was a number three person, like Hillary Clinton, State Secretary of State. And he said to me, I have your book, and I don't like it. And I said, and my heart sunk. I said, there was no chance of me to get into Darfur. But they cleared my visa. The visa I have, it's a picture of it in the book. It's unusual. You can't get it. It's a free visa. When I flew in, they had to fly me into Khartoum. The government did. There's no commercial flights. There's nothing like that. The only other way I could have gotten is through an NGO, but then I would have been restricted from saying anything. So they flew me into Nyala, the largest city, and they showed me what they wanted to show me. They showed me they're working on a water plant. They showed me that they're doing different things. But they also took me to a refugee camp. That's when I verified what was going on. It's a very arid country there. The Sahara is moving down, and it's creating real problems for the farmers and for the nomads. They're all starving. And I spent time, and then I got back to Khartoum. From there, I had planned to go in via the south, but I couldn't do that before I went because they would have known, and they wouldn't have let me in. So I went to then I went back to Nairobi, and then back up to Lokochogia, and then took an old Russian 1946 plane in. When I flew in, it was like an MRI. Your teeth chatter, it's so noisy. And a three-hour flight into this very, very, very desolate land. And you're going to hear more about this place called Jacques because of the fact that there's mass migration going on because of the starvation going on. And they cannot go east. They can't go north in the desert. They can't go west into Chad. So they're going to have to go south. So this camp, which is over 200,000 now, I think will be some kind of large and will be a major effort for the United Nations and or NGOs in the United States. But most people don't realize that 80% of the food that goes into Darfur is U.S. paid for.
It's among other things, a cautionary tale about the potential effects of climate change.
Very much so. Or abuse of land.
Yeah.
In other words, it's both. The Sahara is moving south, and it is problematic because the earth has been warming. But it was a cause route, but it wasn't the only route. The big route was the coming of the brown Muslim against the black people, and that cultural difference. It could be bridged, but it has to be bridged with love and care. And for a long time it was, but then all of a sudden there was a political decision in Khartoum to use the brown nomads to put down the rebellion, and all of a sudden you had an enormous ethnic cleansing.
Now, how did you, once you got to the places that you visited, actually form relationships with people? Because your photographs are so striking, and it's clear that you have formed some kind of connection with the people whom you photograph.
Whenever I go into an area like this, I tell them, I'm just a photojournalist. I want to tell your story. In the South, I'm well known. The Africa book, Africa, the Holocaust of Rwanda and Sudan, is a very, very well-known, very well-accepted book as a history book of that area. So when I go into the South, there are no problems. I go alone. There is no problem. I went to New Mountains alone. I went into Darfur alone.
And there's not a language barrier?
Always there are people that interpret, that can interpret. There's always somebody that's been to school or has some English, and I find them there. But I go and there's no guards or anything. There's no contingent of people.
Right.
Rather, it is. So I tell them what I'm doing, and invariably they warm right up to me. These people have been under a lot of travail. They could be very suspicious, and I'm so thankful they've been so open with me.
We're talking to Lucian Niemeyer. His new book of photographs is called Darfur. He will be at Collected Works this Friday, tomorrow, July 10th at 6 o'clock at Collected Works' new location on Galisteo Street. Do you see any hope? What kind of hope do you see? I mean, some of the pictures have very smiling and hopeful-looking people in them here and there.
When I give lectures now, what I do is I go into the root causes of genocide, whether it's ethnic cleansing, etc. I say that all souls in this world, by all the religions, are created by God. They should have a dignity. They should have a respect. Where one group of people looks down on another group of people and loses the quality of the soul or the respect for the soul, that's when you have genocide. And I go into that very carefully, because until we start to solve these problems, whether they're cultural, whether race, whether they're political. In our country, we have that divide going on now politically. We create problems that are absolutely enormous and almost impossible to solve. In the case of Darfur, it will take a regime change. It'll take the president will not let us in because of the fact that he is indicted and he will get tried and he will get killed. So obviously, he will maintain his dictatorship as tightly as he can. We have put sanctions, we have done many, many things, but we've not been able to crack the fact of how to get into Darfur. There is the African Union. They have now 10,000 troops there, and they're totally ineffective. They sit in there. Their morale is low. They're not well run. They sit in their camps. When they go out, they get harassed by the rebels. So it's a very difficult solution, and it's, you know, it's easy to cry, save Darfur. But until the world order determines that all genocides are against the law, and they determine that the world will stop them, we're not going to stop them. And the only way to really stop genocides is to respect human beings.
Lucian Niemeyer, thanks so much for being with us. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can also find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz presents an hour of European jazz artists. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao. Thank you.